So how we usually begin is to take a 30-minute period for meditation. Now let me warn you that the first 15 minutes of that silent meditation will be me speaking, directing you in terms of the meditation. So don't get frustrated. I do stop. And then we'll have some period of time to be quiet. But I need to give you the instructions. So this is when I do it. And these instructions will be for this week's meditation. They will be inclusive of last week's meditation. So you can sort of pick up the pieces if you missed last week, this week. So sit in a straight position. If you're on a chair, that means your feet parallel to one another, not your legs crossed. And if you're on a chair, and this is the most important part, swing your back away from the back of the chair so you're sitting independently of the back of the chair. That increased exertion of a little bit of independence from the chair is just enough to keep you awake, keep you alert. And of course, if you're on the floor, you can sit cross-legged or straddled in whatever way you'd like. Hands can be folded in a way that's most comfortable for you. But again, squaring your shoulders is very, very important. And just letting your, at first it doesn't feel like a convenient posture. But as you begin to practice this or the chair position, you'll begin to be relaxed within that posture. And relaxation is the crucial first step to meditation. So as you come into the meditation hall and as you sit down, release the day. Just psychically release the activities of the day so that you're not mulling over an incomplete conversation or trying to settle a score or decide what you're going to do tomorrow. You're really here and available to the present moment. Along with that, the encouragement is to relax. Not only your physical body, but also the brain itself. Just take any stress and relax it. You'll notice that the power of relaxation, if you don't move it towards being sleepy or losing consciousness, will increase your ability to pay attention. Stress does not help paying attention. It doesn't aid. Relaxation does. So a deep sense of calm. Looking at your face area, relaxing your jaw, your eyes so they're not tightly shut. Dropping your shoulders away from your neck and squaring them. Softening your belly so that on an in-breath, you'll feel your stomach expand, and on an exhalation, you'll feel it contract. So there's a natural rhythm associated with each breath, and that rhythm has a physical sensation associated with it. How do you know you're breathing? One of the ways is that you feel the physical sensation of your belly moving with each breath. Another sensation is the rising of the chest and the falling of the chest with each breath. And a third sensation is the feeling at the nostrils, the nose tip, the breath coming in and the breath leaving. My suggestion is to focus in on the abdominal area as your primary area of focus. And the reason for that is that the other two are too close to the brain and the thinking that occurs within the brain. So to give you a little distance between the words and the thoughts you're having and the physical sensation that you want to attune to, I would suggest working with the sensations at the belly. But choose the one that fits you most comfortably and then stay there. Now, relaxation is key, as I mentioned. And as we relax, the world of sensation begins to open to us. You begin to feel your body sitting. So just get a sense of being embodied in this moment. Knowing, there's a knowing quality in the sense that you know that you're sitting. You know that your hands are placed on your knees or wherever they might be. You know that you're breathing. That grounds you, that orients you, that gives you a coordinate for your life. The body is a beautiful staple in meditation. It's an anchor for our orientation to the world. Now, what usually happens when you rest your attention upon something like the breath is that you lose focus and you begin to think about how you're doing or what you've been doing or what you're going to be doing or the person next to you or whatever it might be. So whenever that happens and you get taken away by the thinking, which will happen many, many times, don't assume that you made a mistake by going off in the thought. That's just the way we've been trained. We've trained ourselves in the past to think rather than to actually experience. And so we are reversing that and learning to experience first and think secondarily. So when you tune into your breath, let's say you're at the belly, if it's helpful to just tell yourself very gently what the belly is doing as it's doing it. So it's rising on the in-breath or falling on the exhalation. And so saying to yourself very gently, rising, falling, to accompany the physical sensation, not to get lost in words, and allowing each breath to deeply settle yourself into a more relaxed pose. And then as you get lost in thought, even if it's been several minutes, and when you're alone meditating, it often is several minutes before we wake ourselves up when we're new to meditation. Doesn't matter if it's been however long it's been. What matters is what you do once you realize you've been gone. So what you want to do is relax your body. Let that sense of relaxation, let the breath come through that sense of relaxation and reconnect with it. So what I don't want you to do is get anxious or uptight because you've lost the breath. When you lose your breath and you know, you can just relax and let the breath return to you rather than you going out and searching for the breath. It's there. If you want it, you'll find it. Now that was the practice as laid out last week. This week we're going to add another dimension of the practice, and that is other physical sensations besides the breath. So that if while you're sitting, a competing physical sensation should be more predominant than the breath, for instance, an itch, or tingling sensation, or the touch of the breeze or wind on her body, or perhaps most often pain, physical pain, our knee hurts, our back. Instead of staying with the breath, move to the competing sensation and stay with it gently, especially if it's painful. Be very relaxed. Move with the sense of relaxation into it. Being present with that sensation until it becomes less predominant, then returning to the breath. Since the breath is continuous, you always have somewhere to go. The other sensations will come and go on their own. But they're equally as important to observe as the breath. There's nothing special about the breath. It's our default position where we can place our attention. What we're learning is how to be present without thinking about what's occurring. So as you're present to pain or an itch or even the breath, there may be a little commentary in the background that says where you are, what you're doing. It may even claim it to be boring or whatever it might be. Doesn't matter, just let that commentary go. Your job is to focus in on the actual physical sensation that is not governed by those words. So stay with the actual experience, the physical experience, not what you're saying about it. Learning the difference between those two is much of the practice early on. The difference between what is actually happening and what I am saying about what is happening. For instance, when there's pain, there's going to be the physical sensation of pain. And then there's going to be, the jets are scrambled. You're going to exaggerate how terrible it is. Oh, this is worse pain. I know that if I don't move, I won't be able to stay here for another minute. This is the old injury I had when I was in high school. It's just flaring up. It will place an exaggerated significance to the pain. And that's fear. So you're learning the difference between the actual physical sensation of pain and the fear response to it, which is very important. Stay with the actual physical sensation and relax. Deeply relax. Relax, observe, and allow what is there. Relax. Observe so that you're looking, you see it, and allow it to be there. Let it be included in your consciousness. Don't try to exclude it. Don't try to deny it or turn away from it or distract yourself from it. Just being present with it. That's enough. So now I'll be quiet and we'll sit for the next 15 minutes quietly. Explore this afternoon, this evening, about what the nature of meditation is, the direction it takes, sort of some self-corrective pointers and some ways that we can move forward within our meditation. Now, meditation, as many of you have heard, and have a variety of different techniques associated with it. The ones we are practicing now is called mindfulness meditation or Vipassana meditation. That's a Pali word that means insight, sight into. And I'll explain what that is in a minute. But basically, what meditation is it's making us more conscious. That we're beginning to recover our life. Life that has been habituated, the parts of our life that we place on kind of automatic drive. As some of you stare off now into the distant, that's what I'm talking about. That's the habituation. That's the automatic drive that many of us Live Within. I was watching a PBS series called The Brain. I hope some of you saw it because it was a very good series by a psychiatrist named David Eagleman. And he just laid out really meditation from the brain's point of view. And he talked about the brain being a conditioned organism. So the organ of the brain is purely a repetitive organ. It only does things that it knows it's, that it's had an experience and a format and an image to do. And so within that sphere called our brain is essentially our life is being driven forward by these neurological conditioning. And we can certainly see it in ourselves. If we've had a bad experience with someone, the next time we see that person, we are set to have another bad experience with them. We don't see anything really fresh and new. We see it from the perspective, from the vantage point of our past learning, of our memory. And so the way the brain works is that it looks upon the situation as best it can, although the perception itself is configured within the neurological response. And then, in the moment of perception, there's a memory associated with that perception. And then there's the actions that are being driven from the memory rather than from the current situation. And so basically we live in the past. We live with what has been, not with what currently is. The key point in meditation is that we're going to switch that around. There's no way for you to shut off your memory, nor would I ask you to if you could. But there's a way of knowing that the memory is arising and being able to step out of that pattern sequencing into a new orientation, allowing what has been to be what has been. And yet there are new interfaces. The way that we act is from a fresh start. The problem is that what our memory is tied to as a species is our sense of survival. When we were evolving out of the trees of Africa onto the plains, we lost our protective shield, which was to climb higher. We weren't fast, we weren't ferocious. We had to develop something that allowed us to survive. And what we developed was our ability to cognize or abstract or conceptualize a situation. So when we saw a stick, it wasn't just a stick. We were the only species that could see it as a spear and then use it to advance our cause in the direction that we wanted to. Then whenever we saw a stick, we would think spear. Is this going to be a good spear or not a good spear? And then of course, on and on it goes. With each and every object that we perceive, we begin to equate the image that we've had with it to that particular object. Suddenly, we're no longer seeing what's in front of us. We're seeing what the image means to us. When we live with what the image means to us, we live in an abstract world of ideas, away from the groundedness of our actual experience. Now, as you sit down in meditation, many of us, the first experience of meditation many of us have, is that how much thinking there is. We're being flooded by thought all the time. I don't know about you, but when I first sat down, I couldn't believe the number of thoughts I was having. I didn't realize that that was going on all the time. When I was quiet, it became obvious. And it also became extraordinarily frustrating because I couldn't turn them off. There was no off switch. And they were governing everything. And this is what I mean by living in an abstract world, is that we live at the expense of a grounded orientation to life, and our abstract qualities, the images, the memories, the ponderance, the past, becomes the way we interface. Instead of living currently with life, we live with what we have known life to be. There are advantages to that. The advantage is, early on, it meant our survival. It allowed us to go from the bottom of the food chain to the top of the food chain. Now suddenly we were the hunters rather than those who were being hunted. It allows us to know things. If you look around in the room here, you'll see all the things that you visualize, you perceive, you know what they are. That knowledge didn't come from tonight. It came from the fact that you know what a chair looks like, and this fits that particular description, and so you know what to do it, use it for. And so our life is just this expanse of the knowledge base of what we have lived with. What happens is that we live at the expense of the true living experience at hand. If I can show you in more exact terms what that means, last week when some of you were standing and noticing the sensation of your feet to the floor, I asked you to pay special notice to that because you were forming words about the nature of where the feet rested on the floor. It was soft, it was smooth, it was warm or cold or whatever it might be. So those words formed in your mind. And I then suggested, I said, what does the actual experience of smooth or soft feel like as opposed to the word? The word really does just carries an image of what that experience is. It doesn't carry the essence. It doesn't carry the liveness of the experience within it. And if you were going to tell somebody about your walking meditation, you'd say, yeah, it was really soft and it was nice and I moved this way and I feel it. And all of that would be fine and they would understand as much as their memories would allow them to. And neither one of you would have touched the experience as being alive. And so the way we communicate in abstract terms has its own standards, has its own reasoning, has its own logic, but it doesn't touch the actual fabric of what life is, the actual present moment experience. And when we live outside of the present moment, within that abstract world, part of ourselves, our life, is being missed. And you'll become more and more familiar with the parts that are being missed as you recover yourself through the meditation. You begin to recognize how you've misinformed yourself about the nature of who you are, about the experiences of your body and what the body is and the actual sensations that govern it and your emotions and what the emotions actually feel like, not what you're afraid they mean, that's the abstraction, but what they actually feel like and whether they're just more of the mechanism, the habitual conditioning that the mind puts forward, or whether you own them as an experience. I am angry, we say. Or is it just anger arising? When we get a true orientation to our inward life, then we begin to have a sane way of working with it when it does arise. When we only know it from the fact that when my father was angry, I got abused. Then when I see anybody being angry, I'm afraid and contract away from that person. Then we never explore the fact that anger may be safe, may be a safe emotion to have. We only know it from what it's meant to us in the past, not from its current experience. So we rediscover ourselves. We rediscover all the different facets of ourselves that we've long since sort of thrown away. And may I say that as a species, like every species that I know of, even the smallest worm or even perhaps an amoeba, will move away from the unpleasant. If the water is too warm or too cold, it'll move towards a different stream of temperature. We too have that same disposition. We move automatically towards what is pleasant and away from what is unpleasant. So we've tried to make our lives lived only within the pleasant. Well, it doesn't work because in any moment there are both the pleasant and the unpleasant. And when we just try to make it pleasant, It never is pleasant enough. We didn't adjust the dials right. And so there's an edge, no matter how deeply we relax, we think, oh, I still have that back problem. I have to go see. There's always some edge that keeps us a little off balance. That's called discontentment. When we can learn to abide within both the pleasant and the unpleasant, then there's a sense of relaxation that we can bring to any situation because we've learned how to accompany that situation without trying to contract at the expense of the other side of the equation. So the image that comes to mind is that an untrained mind, think of a ball that you place on a hill, and then you hit that ball, the unpleasant experience, and the ball rolls away very quickly. It wants nothing to do with it. You put the ball on the top of the hill and you hit it to the right side, that's a pleasant experience, and it tries to run after that experience and hold on to that. Okay, that's the untrained mind. You take the hill and you invert it into a U, and you put the ball in the middle of that U, and the trained mind, when that ball is hit, moves for a while and comes back to center. It doesn't get thrown off course. So the trained mind doesn't move from that sense of sanity, from that sense of allowance, from that sense of openness. And that's what the meditation is meant to do. You see, all of the things I was talking about is because we are unconscious to our action. We don't realize that running away from the pleasant has a downside. And that downside is that we forever run away from anything that's irritable, and our life becomes more and more narrowly defined by what is acceptable. And that creates tension and stress, that creates contraction and anger and cynicism, disappointment, annoyance, all of that comes from that simple unwillingness to experience life just as it is. How about denial? Many of us have parts of ourselves that we just refuse to look. We don't want to see. We don't want to admit are there. Other people know they're there. Your spouse or partner can give you a very good description of what you're denying. But we don't want to see it. Even though we have a sense that it's there, we don't want to see it. That kind of conditioned aversion to what is difficult leads to its own difficulty, to its own suffering. As we try to protect and defend ourselves, but also we try to build an image that's separate from the actual fact of what and how we present. So what we're doing in meditation is we're learning to be conscious of ourselves. We're learning to face the situations and not pretend that they are different than what they are. We are willing to look at our defense mechanisms and how it is that we rationalize, or how it is that we cajole or turn away from, or all of the different defenses. We're learning now that that is just a reaction of the small amoeba to hot water. That there's a possibility here for a different way of participating in life. You see, what we're learning is how the whole mind, the awareness of the whole mind, not just one aspect of the mind, not just trying to be conscious of my sense of touching this and the mindfulness of ringing the bell and hearing the bell, but really what are the tensions that are latent within us? And how do we live protecting and defending those images? And are those images worth defending? Those are important questions. That's what we're stepping into in meditation. Notice I'm not giving you any philosophy to believe in. In fact, the less you believe in philosophy, the more ready you are to actually experience life as it is. I'm not encrypting anything in spiritual language. There's no Buddhist way of thinking. There's just looking at ourselves as we are and moving and deciding for ourselves, because no one's going to push you beyond your willingness to move forward as to whether you want to know yourself any deeper than you already are. If you don't, I was in hospice care for many, many years. You will die in character. Now look at your character and tell me if you're ready to die. Because it won't change unless you're willing to look at those areas of yourself. Another important point is that nothing changes until we see it. It doesn't change theoretically. I know many of you have been to workshops, nice presentations, skillful presenters, laying out this or that, and you think, oh, I've got to remember that. You write it down and then leave and forget all about it. Because it didn't come into your bones. It wasn't realized by you. It wasn't something you saw, it was something you thought about and decided would be very good to include. In this practice, we're not interested in your intellectual understanding. We're interested in the realization, the bone marrow of your soul, changing the very basic ways that you react to or open to experiences at hand. Fundamental. Let me give you a fundamental difference. Again, keep within the idea, stay within the understanding that all meditation is meant to do is to make us more conscious. That's all we're doing. Ask yourself, what isn't enhanced by being more aware of it? If you could come up with something that you would prefer not being aware of, that's where you're unconscious. If you're willing to be aware of something, there's value to that awareness. There's a learning that takes place there that will expand you to a different level of quietude, a different level of contentment, a different level of settledness and sanity in your life. We just don't know where to begin because no one's giving us the right orientation to how to live. It's really interesting. Okay, so here's a key component. Facts, experiences, are friendly. I did not say some facts are friendly. All facts are friendly. Now you can begin to sense how far we live from the factual relevance of life. We don't like the facts, so we turn away from them, or we argue them, or we protest. And that protest has an internal response of reactivity in us. So when we turn away from a fact, it creates additional pain in us from the anxiety we have about facing that fact. When I was a young meditator, Harvard University came to the meditation center where I was meditating, and we were doing a three-month retreat. And the three-month retreat, Harvard University, before the retreat began, had us plunge our hand into ice water. And we were to give two responses. The first response was how cold and painful the experience was. The second response was how fearful we were of the pain, And so you can imagine, because try it sometimes, put your hand in cold water and just stay there for a while. You start worrying about what's happening to your hand. And so the numbers of this before the retreat began were very high, consistently high. 9, 9, 9, 8, 9, 9, 10, 9, like that. Right? Then they came back. We sat for 3 months. They came back at the end. And they had us plunge our hand back into cold water and had us again recite two numbers. One is how cold we felt the water was. And two, how damaging we felt, how fearful we were of that cold. The first numbers stayed pretty much the way they were in the pre-test, in the prior test. Very high, 9, 8. There was cold. Didn't 30 days or 90 days of sitting didn't change the fact. It made us more aware of that. The second set of numbers went down appreciably. The fear of what that cold would do went from 9 to 2 to 1. What had happened was that the reactive response to the fact of the cold diminished considerably. We weren't afraid of it. First of all, you know, our Harvard would get sued if it was going to damage your hand. But secondly, there was a settledness in being willing to feel the cold water and having had enough experience during that practice to also understand that the secondary reaction, which is the fear response, wasn't the fact. The fact was the coldness of the water. It wasn't the anxiety about the cold. And those two became separate. And so but are usually so confused that we think the fact is the reaction. Now, when you think the fact is the reaction, that's a blurring of the fact with the abstract. The fact and the abstract. They get confused because we haven't learned how to differentiate between what we're saying to ourselves about what's going on and what's really going on. Right? Somebody looks at you cross, angry. And because we each have the predisposition to think that the anger that the person is expressing is about me and how awful they're seeing me, because likely I believe myself to be awful, I then associate the way they're grimacing with my own sense of person, temperament, character. Oh, they don't like me, no wonder, right? What's there to like? That's how most of us handle a situation like this. That's the blending of the fact of somebody making a frown with their conversation, the inward conversation of making that that you're the certifiable reason for that grimace. When you have enough space and quietude in you, you don't associate what other people are doing with your own internal response. You see life as it is, rather than your interpretation of it, and which is often to your benefit to see it the way it is. It's suffering. The more conscious we become, the less we suffer. That's a key point. The more conscious we become, the more we see that all facts are friendly. Because what they do is often show us our reaction to them, which I can deal with when I'm making this inward statement about how bad I am because somebody's frowning. I can deal with that. I can say, wait a minute now, is this true? And of course it's not. Immediately you see that it's not. But it's not all jumbled up. It's not like a dryer, you know, with the clothes just, it's not like that. You see immediately what's there, and you see immediately your interpretation of what's there. And why do you want to go down that road? It cuts it short. It cuts it clean. And you save yourself from the agony of your own conditioning, which is always what the brain does. It puts on the stamp, the model, the image that you have lived with. And usually those models in this culture aren't very good and aren't very satisfactory. And so when things come up around you, you immediately put that interpretation upon things. And it has nothing to do with you at all. And even if it does, even if the person is frowning because they don't like me, why should that then mean that I'm not likable? They have their problem with me through their own interpretation, through what they're seeing. Not because there's something intrinsically wrong with me. And so that's also shown to you. Get a sense of how deep this goes, how much freedom there could be in us being able to live within comfortably our own experience and not confuse what we're seeing with what we're interpreting, by what we're interpreting that scene. So this is where the practice takes us. It takes us into the rich quietude of being able to see life for what it is, rather than our opinionation of life, what we opinionate about life. Facts are friendly for one reason, because they show us the difference between what we see and our interpretation. Each of us have the one necessary quality, and I don't have to go around and see a show of hands. If you're alive, you have this quality. And that is awareness. That's pristine. That is, it goes through the filters of our belief system, of our memories, and it comes out anything but pristine. But when you see and hear the memories that it's going through, you can recover its purity. It's called bare attention. It's attention before we opinionate. It's a tension that we're learning by being present to our breath. We're learning the difference between the awareness of the sensation, that's the purity, that's the pristine quality of just paying attention, and then there's a commentary. And most of us never recognized the difference between those two. We thought the commentary was what we were seeing. That those two were one and the same thing. Now, as we pull them apart, we begin to see that the breath and all of the stuff that's going on up here, which may or may not have anything to do with the breath, usually it has something to do with you and how awful of a meditator you are because you can't find the breath. And all of the ways that you degrade yourself, and all of the evaluations and judgment you bring on to yourself, that has nothing at all to do with the simple ability to see. Get a sense of how important this is. You see? That's why we offer it based upon a person's ability to pay rather than charging you $1,000. That's how important it is that people understand this very simple principle. Because then it would be just for the elite. And believe me, it's for everyone. But it needs to be practiced. It needs to actually be taken in and practiced. It is not good enough to have it be like a workshop. Oh, that sounds interesting. You have to start applying the principle to your daily life. That's the homework. That's the sitting practice. This is not an intellectual experience. This is a realized experience. You will come to a point when you recognize in yourself, not by remembering what he said in the second class, but because it's a part of your own fabric, a part of your own selves, you'll no longer believe that the outside observation has much at all to do with the facts that are actually occurring. So here's how simple it is. We're training our attention to be bare, B-A-R-E, not B-A-E-A-R, not ferocious, stripped of words, quiet attention. And we're just putting our attention upon different facets of life. We've started with the body. The body's an important grounding because, and we have a lot of opinions about our body. Opinions that you will see, and this is the downside, this is the shadow side of the meditation, is that it will start opening up places where you've been unconscious. And people say, hey, I'm feeling worse about myself, not better. Don't worry, stay the course. Don't flee. Because if you do stay the course, you start feeling better after a while. In the beginning, you start noticing all the places we haven't wanted to go because we believed in what we have thought about ourselves. All the ways that we keep ourselves diverted from facing the fact. But as we start just bringing attention into the body, the stability and ground of the body, first it's an anchor for us. Nothing happens until you know where you are. Secondly, nothing happens until you're willing to see from where you are. You aren't going to be able to fix anything by having an intellectual understanding of what it is. You can't do it. You have to actually experience what's wrong, and then you can make the adjustments. It's a difference between an auto mechanic who's qualified and practiced and spent years adjusting their engine to somebody who reads a book about auto repair. So as we become tuned, and as we become adjusted, we begin to see, and yeah, my God, I'm so vain. We look at all the things, I'm so vain. Okay, that's okay. It's okay. You've always been vain. Don't worry about it. It's going to get better. It's not going to get worse. Just see where you are. See the fact of where you are. That's all. Just okay. I'm vain. Yeah. Or I'm so selfish. I'm so self-centered. That'll be something that almost every one of you will see because your lens is self-governed. It all comes in this way. And you think that you are the default position of everyone's life. You're not. And you think, oh, but I, what? So it begins, you begin to get humble. You start living with more humility. That's a good thing. And it feels good. You start noticing why and how it is that you cause yourself problems. Let me show you how quickly that happens. This is, if you get this point, this is at the key, right? You're sitting there and you're taking in the facts and suddenly the fact is not what you want it to be. I'm hungry. I don't like being hungry. That's not a fact I like. I'm hungry. So you conjure up in your mind what's called a desire. And you said, if I had it together, I'd get up and eat something. But I'm sitting in meditation. So I can wait 15 minutes, can I? No, I can't. I'm hungry. And you have to start having this argument. Okay? Your ability to drop the argument and just live for 15 minutes with hunger is the difference between whether you will suffer or not. Drop the words and you won't suffer. You'll feel the physical sensation of hunger. You won't forget you're hungry. You just won't weigh in on some exaggerated significance about how hungry you are and what you need to do and how awful the world is that, and what meditation, what it's only this much. It's only this much. Now you apply that rule to every time you react or get disappointed. You have an expectation, right? The meal, you have a certain expectation that the meal is going to be served and a certain thing you like. You show up at the dinner table and it's not there. The thing you were counting on it being, It's not there. I'm disappointed. I can't eat this now. I don't want it. Take it away. That's suffering. Show up at the table. You feel the moment of disappointment. You release yourself from it, and you go ahead and eat whatever is there. That's the difference. Which way do we want to live? Which way? Because it's possible, you already know that it's possible to live in disappointment by giving things exaggerated significance. I tell you, and those of us who are up here can tell you, it's also possible to live the other way. So I'm going to give you three words for the summation of the meditation. And I want you to notice that each of the words holds a sense of contentment within them, a sense of ease. No one is asking you to do anything super mannish or womanish. Relax. Let that word burn into your psyche. Because if you're not relaxed, you're already in dispute. And you don't even have the awareness to know where you are disputing what life is. There's some contraction in you, there's a dispute. The more you're willing to relax, the more you're willing to release that dispute. Disputes cause contraction. Stress, tension, relax. Now it's interesting because relaxation, we're afraid of it. We feel we need to keep ourselves kind of in a sense of protectiveness or defensiveness because the world is so hostile or we're hostile within the world, or if I release and relax and solve the things that I know I contain, my mind is there, all this stuff would come out. I used to keep a sign when I was very young. What was the sign? If I show you who I am and you don't like me, that's all I have. See? So I want to protect myself from showing you who I am and create a fiction that you can like. And that's how much tension. And when we come to a sense of relaxation, we see the tension that the need to hold life a certain way creates. We have to be courageous in this. This isn't for the faint of heart. We have to be willing to release that boundary and see whether the world looks better from the other side than from the side we are currently on. Relax. The second word, observe. Just see. I'm willing to look. I will look at anything. It's not pretty, but facts are friendly. I'm willing to look. I'm willing just to look and see. It doesn't have to be pretty. In fact, when I'm in a state of angst about what is there, there's something I'm trying to protect, some image of myself that I'm trying to shore up that isn't true. And so instead of looking at myself the way I am, I'm trying to protect myself by being who I think I am. And it just doesn't work. So observe. Just be willing to go wherever the information takes us and be willing to look. That will serve you. That will be the essence. That could be the essence of a life of joy. It actually gets, believe it or not, joyful. You want to know where there's a rub because you aren't free when there is. So have I said anything that's upsetting? You said, relax. How's that upsetting? Relax. I've got to have my six shooter. Observe. I'd rather have my blinders on. Okay, the third one, allow. Just allow what is there. You don't have to do something about it. I'm talking about an internal response. An emotion arises. Remember, if you don't allow it, you won't be observing it. If there's something that's happening inside of you that you don't want to see, you're not going to allow it, and you're not going to see it. So these three words work in tandem with one another. Relaxation releases the tension of defensiveness. Observation shows up for what is there. Allowance accepts what is there without adding any more tension to what's already there. Relax, observe, and allow. Whenever your meditation gets difficult, go to those words and apply it. Okay, let's be relaxed to this. I have an itch. I just feel like, instead of scratching or just relax. Now just observe it. Now open up a psychic dimension that doesn't try to squeeze it out of existence. Just let it be a part of the fabric of life for a moment. Notice the contentment that are associated with those words. Okay, I'll So, at what point did you lose awareness? At what point? That's an interesting question. So, when do you go astray? When are you no longer sitting where you are? Isn't that amazing? Because then, you're not where you are. It's like, what is he talking about? This is getting strange and weird. Being where you are is strange and weird. Not being where you are is strange and weird. So just keep bringing yourself back, returning again. And be gentle with how you return again, especially in your meditation. Don't berate yourself, no matter how long you're away, and no matter how often you have to recall coming back to your breath. Don't berate yourself. You're working against where this is taking you. This is taking you out of that self-condemnation. This is taking you into a free way of looking at your attributes, a very different way of sizing yourself up than from the conditioned way we have believed ourselves to be, through the school teachers, through the parents, through the significant others, through their judgments, through that's what we live within. We can step out of that, though. That's will be other lectures. I want to just mention before we get to the questions that this book, The Experience of Insight by Joseph Goldstein, is kind of a text for the course for these 6 weeks and day long. The day long is February 20th for those of you who are just coming for the first time today. So you mark that day on your calendar, and I'll have more to say about that. But mark the day, because it will be from 9 to 4:30, the full day. Joseph is a renowned Buddhist teacher, and so this really gives you the meditation from a Buddhist perspective. It's actually interesting because I'm not giving you a lot of Buddhism, I'm just giving you the principles that are the sort of the straight scoop. But to read, it's very beautiful to see how Buddhism engages these principles. And he also gives you meditation instruction and a dialogue and question and answers, much like the themes of these particular times together in these classes. So, Joseph Goldstein, The Experience of Insight. If you want to get that book, I would recommend it. Now let me just open it to whatever questions you might have. And if you don't mind speaking up and making the questions relatively short so I can repeat them for the camera and for others who aren't able to hear as well. So anyone. Yes.
Often things are phrased that to observe if something is unpleasant, then the unpleasant. Does the same thing apply for that which is pleasant?
So it's a good question about, we often frame the logic of staying with things when they're difficult or unpleasant because they hold a kind of way that we're missing something that's vitally there, or we're saying something about what's vitally there that's throwing us off and making it aversive. What about the pleasant? Is there a way that we get lost within the pleasant? Most assuredly there is. What happens to the pleasant is, of course, different. We're not being aversive to what's there. We're grasping at what's there. We're trying to make it last longer than its normal lifespan. We don't want it to go away. Well, guess what? It goes away. In fact, one of the basic themes of the meditation is it starts showing you the universality, the laws that operate all the time around us and through us, but that we are ignorant or that we miss. One of those laws is the law of impermanence, that everything changes. Now, we live like we would like to protect everything from changing if it's pleasant. We buy a new car and we wake ourselves up at 2 o'clock to make sure no one's run into it or whatever we might do. The fact though is that things are going to change. We're each going to get old. We're going to get ill at some point in our life and we're all going to die. But all things go through that. The spring, summer, autumn, and winter. And so when we start recognizing and living within that law, rather than as if the law didn't exist, denying that it's there, we let things be pleasant for as long as they last, and then when they don't last, when they start leaving, we don't go try to hold on to that experience or try to replicate it. I don't know how many of you have seen some of the beautiful sunsets that are here, but I was having such a, I went, wow, this is really a beautiful sunset this summer, actually. And then I said, boy, I have to come back here tomorrow night and see this again. Well, guess what? It was raining. And because I've been practicing a while, I wanted it pleasant, like it was the night before. I didn't want it raining, right? So the degree of my suffering is the amount of time I spent hoping that this rain would go away so that the sun would be. You see, that's suffering. You can suffer on the left side of the scale or you can suffer on the right side of the scale. Either way, wanting something to be different than the way it is the nature of dissatisfaction and struggle. Wanting it to be different than the way it is. Now let's just for a second realize that life, in the immediacy of life, is only one way. It's this way. It doesn't hold our expectations. It doesn't hold our desires. It doesn't hold how we want it to be. It's this way. You see, in the immediacy, I'm not saying, oh, the room's too warm, and there's a thermostat over there, I'm going to get, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the immediacy of the moment, because that's where the suffering arises. I want it to be warmer. It's not warmer. You're going to suffer until you get to the thermostat. And then you have to suffer and wait for the room to warm. The immediacy of the moment is only one presentation. Why is it, or how is it, that we can argue with that presentation? It's absurd. There's not another presentation available to us. There's not an alternative reality. Although the mind, because it's so used to thinking conceptually and remembering a more pleasant moment than the one that's at hand, brings that one as the fact, the other one as a distraction from the fact. Reality becomes a distraction from what you want. The difference between the reality and what you want, that's called struggle, suffering, discontent, ill at ease. See how simple it is? Living it, I've tried to for 42 years. It's a little more difficult than living it. It doesn't mean that you don't move forward regularly as you apply yourself to it. You do, and your life, as the Buddha said, goes from misery to greater happiness. Other questions? Yes?
I know this is not really a question. Well, it is. Could you repeat that again?
Could I repeat that again about
the difference between
All right. So whenever you're cognizing or conceptualizing reality, you're placing your wishes upon what the fact of reality is. Right? It's like, I wish he hadn't said that. He did say that. So you can wish it all you want. But how invested you become in that, how angry or reactive you become in wishing he didn't say what he just said. Think Donald Trump. I'm joking. Not really, but. The investment that you give, your desire, your expectation, as opposed to the reality. Reality only has one face, remember. It looks like this. But I don't want it to look like that. I wanted there to be fewer people so I could get individual instruction. Or whatever. It doesn't matter. You see, whatever you place upon that pristine face of reality, that fact that's in front of us, the difference between that, the distance between that, and the investment you have in the abstract as opposed to the real, that will determine how much suffering you have to go through until you admit that the real is real. I'll show you. Here's an example. And this is said kindly because we all do it. Grief. Someone you cared about dearly has died, let us say. The ability to come to that realized fact, all of that is called, the distance between that is called grief. It's not wanting that person, expecting that person to show up, not wanting that person to have gone. You see, it's the investment. And the more endearing that person was to us, the greater the investment. Finally, after a length of time, sometimes months to years, we come to the realization that that person has died, and we let that fact be the fact. And then the grief tapers off dramatically. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with grief. I'm just saying that that's how the mind works itself to the final disposition of reality that has that person missing within it. We grieve over everything. It's very short. It's not like because not having the room at the right temperature doesn't impact us the same way as missing something. But the process is really the same. And you can usually find the anger, the betrayal, and all of that as part of the mix. Yes, in the back.
Can I stand if I can see you? So I'm thinking about how the facts are friendly, and I'm thinking about things that I care about, like ending racism or climate change. And I guess I'm wondering, where does, how do you engage with any of these things if not from a place of struggle?
Okay, she's looking at social injustice of some of the social ways that we live, like racism, like climate change, and how does that fit this facts are friendly scenario, right? The fact that facts are friendly does not keep us from walking in terms of the way that we feel, the way that we emotionally want life to be. It keeps us from creating a tension that divides and separates those two parties. If you abhor racism and you get prejudice to those people, about those people, and of those people who are racist, that is not different than someone who is prejudiced and how they feel about the race. You see, you have to understand that mostly we bring the same ingredients we're trying to cure to the process. And it doesn't work. It's just the same thing in a different mixture. It's now towards our righteousness. But if you ask the person who is racist, they would also claim to be righteous. Okay, so that is not the point. The point is not you don't say, okay, everything is perfect and I don't have anything to do and I'll just let everybody be racist. No, your heart, because at the center of what is being understood as you begin to see clearly the facts of existence, is that the separation that we have given people and objects is intellectually determined. It's not the fact. The fact is that there is an interconnectedness to life that becomes apparent as we begin to accept things as they are. And from that, we begin to move in accordance with areas of life that are divested or antagonistic to each other. Not because we are righteous, but because it's just the right thing to do. You see a child out in the street with a car coming, you don't say, that's the way things are. You run out there and grab the child and save it, because that's the right thing to do. You see, it's not contentious. So it's not breathing the same philosophy and antagonism into our actions from which the actions came. And it is possible to operate, get things done, without creating further division. But we have to base ourselves deeply in the belief, in the realization of life as being interconnected, which we begin to see. Now, it's not a philosophy or a belief. You begin to sense the interconnection of life. Many of you sense it even before you came into this class. That the visions that we created in life, that things aren't as distant as we claim them to be. In fact, physics is proving that point. It's called particle entanglement or something like that, where
cosmic
entanglement, in any case. It's like they're showing that particles from vast distances can be taught to correspond to each other, so that if the spin of an electron changes, this electron over here changes correspondingly, instantly, not at light speed, which would be communication, but because they're one and the same particle, they're just being perceived as two things from a distance. Quantum entanglement, that's what it's called. And some of the scientists believe that it's far more reaching theory than just two little electrons that are distant from each other. In any case, with, as you quiet down and as we become less abstract in the way we see life, we see that sense of togetherness. You sense it in you very deeply, and you start acting from it. And that'll be a later discourse in this class series about the nature of how our perceptions begin to change. Time for one more question, if there is one. Yes, sir.
Are feelings facts?
You're feeling what?
Are feelings facts?
Are feelings facts?
Yes, in your example before, when you said, I wish, it's like, yes, somebody said something, and you said, well, I wish he hadn't said it. You feel, you wish he hadn't said it.
See? I get it. Yeah. Okay, our feelings facts. Okay, so feelings are our emotions coming up, right? There's a lot of history in every one of the emotions. So it's like anything else. They contain a memory, they contain a whole set of reactive patterns, they constrain an extraordinary sense of self-identity. With each, if you're fearful, you're a coward, if you're, you know, all of that. So to decipher or to feel a feeling separate from the past is the question. The feeling's a feeling. Doesn't change the description, the internal way we see it changes. So is a feeling a fact? Yes. But what we add to that feeling is not a fact. That's what we've added to it from our history. Right? So those are two separate things. And feelings are perhaps the hardest inward process to be able to discern the difference between those two. But they are. You will or can train yourself so that you feel the feelings you're having. You're not disassociating yourself from the feeling. You're very intimate to that feeling. I want to make it clear that we're not distancing ourselves from anything here. But the words that accompany the feeling are not true about the feeling. They're true about the experiences we've had in relationship to the feeling and what circumstances we underwent when that feeling arose. But they aren't connected to the feeling, you see, except by association. So they're not part of the fact of the feeling. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so now I'm going to switch topics, if I could. And for those of you who were here last week, I want to give you homework. And those of you who are here this week, you get the same homework. I'm not going to let up on you. Okay, so sit 30 minutes a day. Sit, meditate 30 minutes a day. Find a time that you can do it quite easily, the beginning of the day or at the end of the day. You're going to have to, everybody's day is already filled, so you're going to have to shuffle around some of your activities so that you have 30 minutes and do that every day. Okay, now if you miss one, it's okay. You know, I can't go on Monday because I missed Thursday. No, just come, but try to sit every day. Try to sit. And if your day is very busy and you can't, go to the spot that you usually sit and make it a routine and make it a regular spot. And say, okay, today I only have 5 minutes, but I'm going to go and stay for 5 minutes. And then you go for 5 minutes and stay the 5 minutes, okay? So if you can't sit 30 minutes every day, stay as long as you can and stay that commitment. Make sure you stay the length of time you said you could go. So, but try for 30 minutes a day. practice walking meditation when you're walking on your own towards a bus stop or downtown or whatever it might be. Allow yourself to really feel and enjoy your body. I gave a little homework sheet, quarter page there, that emphasizes relaxation and ease. If you need one of those, they're out there on the table, please pick one up and practice that as well. Markers. Take an activity, and for those of you who were here last week, you take the second activity. Do any of you want to talk about your first activity? What was your first marker? Anybody who's here that last week want to say what their first marker was? Yes, sir.
I've been doing taking a shower, but I also have a shower.
Shower.
I also have to be mindful not to stay there too long, waste water.
So short showers. Anyone else have a marker that they'd like to share? Yes.
Brushing my teeth.
Brushing your teeth. Combing your hair. Just pick an activity you do every day, but this time, hang a little sign on your toothbrush or your hairbrush that says, be mindful while doing. So you bring total attention to that simple activity while you're doing it. It'll be the hardest assignment you have because your head will spin ahead of itself. It wants to think about what's after the brushing of your teeth, not settle with the brushing of your teeth. And then you get a sense of how far afront, how far forward we live from where we really live. While you're driving to work, you're thinking about work. When you're at work, you're thinking about home. When you're at home, you're worried about work. It's always like that. And to slow this thing down, to pull yourself back in on yourself, so that you're actually sitting in the correct orientation to the moment at large, is hard to do. I give it that, but it's possible. So let these simple markers be an occasion when you're just doing what you're supposed to be doing, just brushing your hair, just brushing your teeth, just short showering. Okay. So that's your homework assignment. Get 8 hours sleep. So 8 hours sleep. I'm not going to keep saying that. You just need to get it. You know, this is about alert attention. If you're not alert and attentive, okay. Donna Basket. My livelihood comes from your generosity. It doesn't come from the registration fees. So whatever money you placed in the basket or in the registration fee doesn't go to me. I have to ask you for whatever else you can offer in the Donna basket. D-A-N-A says Donna for Rodney. If you put some money in that, there's no amount or no one's checking names. It's completely voluntary. But I have all the bills that everyone else has, and this is the way I pay them. So I salute and appreciate your Donna in advance. We're going to sit for a couple of minutes, but when we leave here, if you would leave the first two rows of chairs and stack the rest of the chairs over to my left, below that banner to my left, and leave two rows of cushions and stack the other two rows of cushions right beside you. See where there's already stacked cushions in the corner there. Downstairs, some tables need to be set up. If you would help us set up the tables, the whole thing could be done like in 5 minutes. This shouldn't be happening. This is supposed to be, doesn't he know? Is this a meditation? Case in point, huh? Okay, let's just be quiet for a minute. As you open your eyes, I want to let you know that the two people up here and myself, plus Jerry, who's tending the camera, The three, four of us will be up here for questions. If you have questions that you haven't been able to ask or you'd like to ask for more personally, one-on-one to one of the four of us, you're welcome to do that at the end of each class. So enjoy your week. Enjoy your week and do your homework. Okay, all. Thank you.